Get ready, golf lovers. The boys are teed up and ready to go. Backspin, thanks to Inside Golf.
Welcome to another episode of Backspin, brought to you by Inside Golf Magazine and BMW Australia. Gary Barter is next to me. My name is Larry Kenning. Andrew Bunce is in the studio. Gaz, we have a terrific show. We have an interview with a really interesting guy, Matt Dowling. He's the Acushnet Manager of Leadership and Promotions. Matt Dowling's had this role for a long, long time.
He's a great man, Matt.
And yeah, he knows a lot about Titleist golf, Titleist balls, Titleist everything.
He is Titleist.
He is Mr. Titleist.
In Australia, he is absolutely.
And he knows a lot of the players. I want to talk to him about some of the players, some of the quirkiness.
Yeah.
Is Adam Scott actually real, or is he AI?
Is he that perfect?
I think he's AI. I got a feeling he was created in a laboratory.
Well, his swing is perfect.
Well, everything. His head, his nose, his ears.
Yeah.
He's not real. We'll find out through Matt. We've got a tip, Gaz. It's about how to hit a hybrid properly. What is the correct way to hit a hybrid? Now, its name suggests that it is a cross between an iron and a wood. Do you hit it like an iron or do you hit it like a wood? I've had a little bit of a fiddle and I've always struggled a bit with hybrids, but I think I found the answer, but I want you to confirm it for me later on,
okay.
Guys.
We'll see if you figured it out the right way.
What's in the news? Well, is there, what else is there in the news than LIV Golf, guys? LIV Golf, the public investment fund from Saudi Arabia, is pulling the financial pin on LIV Golf, not because it hates it, not because it doesn't think it's worthy, but because of the war in Iran is costing the Saudi Arabians. It was something like the first 10 days of that war cost $1.2 billion. In 10 days, and they're forking out a lot, billions, to keep LIV Golf going. As I said, I don't think they're unhappy with the product. It's just that the war has belted them, and they've now got to withdraw some of these things they've been funding. And even the I think it's Newcastle United, I think they fund that as well, the soccer team in England. So they do have Formula One, they do have the World Cup coming. So they've had to withdraw money from LIV Golf. Now it's official, I think we believe now, and now we're looking at what's going to happen to LIV Golf, the game that has changed the world of golf. Is it sustainable without the public investment fund? Now, your thoughts, Gaz?
All the reports say that they are now seeking alternative investors.
Mm.
And that's going to be a big ask. Because just from reading, LIV Golf are burning through $100 million a month.
It's extraordinary money, isn't it? When we talk now about, you know, just $100 million just rolls off your tongue, doesn't it?
Well, it's just a massive,
huge,
a massive debt. And I think Nick Adams quoted, Nick being the general manager of Rippers, he said, look, 15 years ago, if you thought an IPL team would be getting $1.4 billion a team, you'd probably laugh at it. And LIV being a startup, and they were definitely looking for the future. And obviously, whether the war was the catalyst or whether it was the public investment fund just looking at this model from day one, I think we're 4 years in to the model, it hasn't really showed signs of getting individual team investments of any sort of weight.
Yeah.
I think Bryson came out and said that his team has $20 million US of sponsors. Well, $20 million it's not even close to covering the cost of his team or even his sign-on fee. And when you look at the other teams, and they do say that LIV is profiting compared to when it started, but in saying that, it's still losing a lot
losing
of money.
Losing less.
Yeah, it's losing less. It's losing less. So moving forward, is the future LIV moving into the DP World Tour?
That's exactly what I reckon is going to happen. I didn't think the DP World Tour were allowed to, let's use the word merge, create some sort of merger with LIV Golf because the PGA Tour bought 40% of the European Tour, but they didn't buy the European Tour. They bought media rights. They actually don't own 40% of the European Tour, which I thought, which frees up the DP World Tour. That arrangement, by the way, was made by a guy called Keith Pelly, who ran the DP World Tour a while ago, and I've met him once or twice. But he seems like a nice guy, and I'm not going to tell him he didn't know what he was doing, but he has critics that suggest that he was clinging on to the old world of the European Tour with the help of the American PGA Tour. He had an opportunity, I believe, to merge directly with LIV Golf back then, but chose not to push them away. I think that attitude has changed, and I think that door is now open. I know Brian Rolapp, the new CEO of the PGA Tour isn't overly excited with that arrangement between the PGA Tour and the European Tour. So he's looking to get out of it. They can drop it like that. They can stop their contract whenever they want. DP World Tour, it's in place, guys. The infrastructure's already there. All these national opens have the infrastructure in place. They just need a little bit of money.
Yeah.
And they need world-class players to get that money, and LIV Golf has that.
As we sit here, we understand that the funding is solid till the end of the season.
Mm.
Then the question would be, at the end of the season, if LIV does fall over, where do the players go?
Yeah, yeah, that's the other side of the coin, isn't it?
Brian Rollup, I think he quoted that players that we see as value to our model or our PGA Tour, so you'd presume they're the players like Bryson.
Bryson and Rahm are number one and two. Is Cam Smith, is he still in that conversation?
Cam's still got a one-year exemption left to play the PGA Tour on the back of his British Open win.
Right.
So, but again, they can say whether they want him or not. I presume they will. Now, you've got players
like... Are you sure?
I would say so.
Okay.
Players champion, British Open champion.
Oh, he's got the goods, but his form, mate.
That's up to them to decide. They've got the... They can make that decision. But then you've got players that signed with LIV only this year. Thomas Dietrich, who was a top 50 player in the world. Laurie Kanter, who forgo a PGA Tour card to go and play LIV.
As did Tom McKibben.
You've got Tyrrell Hatton, who we know is world class, but he hasn't won a major. So it's not like, you know, they could make a category that will take players back that have won a major or won a players' championship, etc. So you've got these players like Neiman, who is obviously a world-class player, but he won't have any category to go back and play the PGA Tour. But they will be able to go and play in Europe.
The PGA Tour, I know they think they're the only tour that exists, in an incredibly insular attitude on the world game. They play for a lot of money, and a lot of that's come from the fact that LIV Golf was created. Now, will that change? Is their own brand, is their own business model sustainable? And with all the extra money that they've had to put in? I'm not sure. I think they'll water theirs down a little bit as well now. They don't need to have 25 million every so often. They don't need to do that. If we're just thinking of just these guys that you just mentioned going back to the PGA Tour, then they've got the product already. You know, in terms of this, why do they have to play for 25 and not 15? So, which means, to finish that point, if they go to Europe, these guys, and they play for 3, 4, 5 million. And if you've played LIV for 5 years, you've got 100 mil in the bank, surely. Can they all just play on the European Tour? This is kind of a fantasy, I suppose. Just play in the DP World Tour and some stuff in Asia. And that's their playing. And they can make a lot of money out of that, surely. Or is the appearance money, does that reappear on the DP World Tour? Like when Seve was playing. A lot of questions, aren't
there? Yeah, there's so many boxes to tick.
That's if LIV dies a natural death, a financial death, right? If it doesn't, I really feel there's some bridge opening there between Europe and LIV.
I think Europe want their profile back as well.
Yeah.
You know, they've been losing the 10 best players on the order of merit every year straight to the PGA Tour. It's been like a nursery.
It's a filter, isn't it? Yeah. It's just a strainer.
And then that's definitely affected the European Tour in regard to just general week in, week out play.
Absolutely.
So I think that Europe may see the opportunity to get Rahm, to get Hatton, to get Poulter, to get Westwood, to get these players back in increasing the profile of their week in, week out events. There's no doubt about it. And the players, they all want to play in the big championships. And as we saw back in the day with Faldo, Montgomery, Seve, Woosnam, they could still play the European Tour, and we would still see them play
the majors.
Yeah, the majors, but also we'd see them play, well, they weren't called signature events back then, but we'd still see them play Riviera, or we'd still see them play Bay Hill, or still see them play the Players. They just weren't actually based in the US. I think everyone wins then.
Let's talk about some of the great courses in Europe that they play. We talk about Riviera, Torrey Pines, you know, the East and the West Swing, and Doral, and, you know, I mean, they're great courses, but are they career-defining wins, like the Genesis?
Well, they're just big championships.
They love the legacy. They just love their, and they've used that legacy tradition, you know, word so much, the American PGA Tour, and I just, you know, I'm tired of hearing it, to be honest. Look, I love Americans. I love the place. Oh, sorry, all the American listeners.
Sounds like it.
God, if I had a PGA Tour card, I would tell them how beautiful they were, every one of them, how gorgeous they were, but I don't, so I can sit here and I can't see it changing in the near future. But I do feel it's very insular. And the world of golf, if the DP World Tour, well, the world is in the actual title of the tour, the World Tour, and LIV Golf are all about the world.
Well, you look at Adelaide, you look at the tournament in South Africa a few weeks ago, they're hugely successful events. The the coverage of LIV, I never felt was up to scratch.
Does get a lot of criticism, doesn't it?
Well, just
even from the supporters.
I know. I've been to many LIV events, and they are.
I
must have been to 20 of them, and they are really great tournaments when you're there. The atmosphere, the quality of play, the feeling of the event. It's amazing when you're physically there on the course, but when I watch LIV on the TV, something's missing.
There's
a disconnect. There's something now. Whether that's because of the format of the shotgun start and it doesn't transfer because you're going from this player to that player and so-and-so's on the 13th and so-and-so's, or whether it's the actual commentary, just the general coverage with the stat keeping, even the website, when you look on the website and you're watching someone on live scoring, like you click on the PGA Tour and you can see where every shot's gone, you see every stat. LIV, after all this time and all the money and the billions of dollars they put into it, to think that they have got such a poor product online, that to me was a big, big, big missed opportunity for them.
It's a case of just turning on our computers every day and seeing what the latest news is. There's so much speculation. They've been criticised, LIV Golf, since their inception. And there's a group of high-profile commentators that just bag the living crap out of it. And it disappoints me, and it gives me the shits, to be honest. And Brandel Shambly's back on song again with all that. And it's like they're bathing now in the fact that it looks like it could fold. So there's all the speculation I'm hearing from that side I don't listen to anymore. They want it to fail, and I'm sick of it. Let's just listen and wait, but make sure you're listening to some objective opinions, not subjective ones.
So we'll see if they can find some more funding to move forward.
Yep, I reckon they will. Some of them might have to water down the purses. Whatever they have to do, they will, I reckon, find a way, and I reckon it's going to involve Europe. Gaz, after this, Matt Dowling from Acushnet Golf.
You're tuned to Backspin. 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 With Larry Canning and Gary Barter.
Well, he's the manager of leadership promotions of Acushnet Golf Australia, Gary. He's on the line now. Matt Dowling. G'day, Matt.
Hi, guys. Thanks for having me.
Absolute pleasure. Mate, can you tell us what manager of leadership promotions is, please?
Big title, isn't it?
It is a beauty.
It's a very big title.
Yeah, so, look, basically, it's the company, Acushnet Company, they have leadership. It's basically tour and next generation amateurs. So we have promotions is obviously our marketing. So we do a lot of our marketing through the best players in the world. We have internally we refer to a document called the Pyramid of Influence, where basically we test all our products, all our processes with the best players in the world. Once they work for them and they verify them, they go to market and get sold to club golfers that you guys are dealing with each and every day.
That's interesting, Matt. It's not always AI, robotic stuff. It goes through the players as well before you release?
Yeah, correct. You know, right now, the company works on a two-year cycle, so we'll release a new Pro V1 golf ball next year, 2 years since the last one, so it'll be the 2027 model. They pretty much start working on that as soon as the 2025 model comes out. Go to the players, what would you change? You know, is it a little bit of spin here, a little bit of extra distance there, and then start working with the players to say, does that work? Once you tweak one part of the golf ball, something changes in the other part. So you might add the spin that player A wants, but then doesn't go as far or fly as high as will feel the way player B wants. It's a continual process.
And when you say you test it, when it goes through the players, when we talk about that, there's about 100 million that use Titleist, isn't there? So it's an amazing story, the Titleist golf ball, and it's been around a long time. When did it actually become? Was it the Pro V1 that really launched it way back in the 80s, or was it 90s, that really launched the success, or was it already pretty popular before that, right?
Yeah, it's been... you can get the full version of the story on the website. Basically, a player missed the short putt and said it wasn't his stroke. There was the ball. Went and x-rayed the ball, and sure enough, this is back in late 20s, early 30s.
It wasn't Doug Sanders missing that putt at the Open.
No, it wasn't Doug Sanders. they used to put, like, weights in a ball bearing type things, and it was off center.
Oh, okay.
And he said, surely we can make a better golf ball than that. So they took it to the Acushnet Rubber Company and designed a golf ball and x-rayed every one to make sure that the weight was in the center. And they've been x-raying golf balls ever since to make sure that process is right. So that was the Acushnet Rubber Company. The first golf ball was an Acushnet, and the lady at the back of the warehouse actually wrote down the script on a serviette when they were trying to name it, and that's her handwriting. It's still our script today
really?
For Titleist.
Tell you what, she could write nicely. She was a calligrapher.
Nice. Beautiful.
Yeah. Tell us about the new driver's just been released, hasn't it? The GTS, has it, it's just taken over from the GT. But it's only really new, isn't it? I mean, some of the players haven't trialled it yet.
We just started our fittings with our tour players and elite amateurs here in the last couple of weeks.
Right.
Feedback's been really good. Look, the GT model's been our last probably four or five driver models have been really popular. I know Gary spends a lot of time on the Live Tour, or has done in the past,
yep.
and a lot of the guys that are non-contracted now are using the GT, and basically the GTS has been improved again for those, more so for those misfits that everyone has.
Titleist, this is going back, it might be five evolutions of driver back, because Titleist always, they had that, it's always been obviously a player's brand, and the integrity of the Titleist and the construction of the Titleist driver has always been phenomenal, but we went through that period, I may be wrong, maybe 10 years ago, where the driver faces were getting quite thin.
On all the drivers, they were cracking.
Yeah, because that perfect algorithm of creating, well, obviously rebound effect is, couldn't have an actual rebound effect, but a lot of the other companies at that time, TaylorMade was the one where their drivers were hot, they really did go well, but they'd break very easily, the faces would cave in, and Titleist, they sort of stuck to their guns, because our drivers would never do that, would they? You'd rarely get one of our drivers that would crack.
If we go back 15 years ago, we tried to keep spin on the ball. Once again, the best players that we dealt with at the top of the pyramid wanted some spin on the ball to be able to shape and manoeuvre the ball how they wanted to. But when you have spin, you also comes with a bit of a sacrifice. So the distance wasn't as long as some of the others. I guess the big change for us in the TS model, probably 10 years ago now, was we were able to keep spin on it, but also give it the distance. So now it's goes a long way, but the guys can still do what they want with the driver as well in terms of in that little fade.
The driver distance is, our Titleist is really, I'm not sure what the data's showing, just from what I'm seeing on the range, our distance is definitely, we don't lose anything to any other driver at the moment.
No. We've got a big gun in the gunfight, that's for sure.
Which is interesting because it's always been about the ball. Well, not always.
The ball is the thing that they're going to roll back, aren't they?
When you think Titleist, you think straight of the Pro V, and who's not using it is like a startling, it's like startling. Oh, doesn't he use the Titleist? Not one of the other 10 brands. But this driver, as you said, Matt, a lot of non-contract players, so that means to the punters out there that they're not getting paid $1 million a week to use a particular golf club. They're just choosing to use it, and they are using it, and they're winning. Matt Fitzpatrick, a classic example right there. He's what sort of year he's had using the, I think it's the GTs. He hasn't got into the GTS yet, but I'm sure he will.
Yeah.
So Matt, with the GTS, obviously all the companies, just the market always demands new gear coming out, and it must be very difficult for the R&D guys to keep up with it. With the new GTS, the evolution of that, how's it upgraded on the one before?
Well, does S stand for too, Matt?
Funnily enough, there's actually a media embargo on this at the moment.
Oh, is there?
Really?
Okay. Oh, well, it's a couple of weeks away before we can go into the...
Okay. That's all right. We'll get you on in 2 weeks.
We can speculate.
This is a jump from what we've had in GT. So it's more forgiving across the face. The dispersion's better for the guys who, they hit the one out of the high toe and the one out of the low heel. The dispersion number's not, where it could be in the thousands of RPMs, it's now in the hundreds. They're still getting the speed off the face and the forgiveness if they don't quite get one the right way. So, they're the two things people are looking for in a driver.
It's interesting what you're saying about the equipment being tested by the best players in the world, the balls, the clubs. Obviously, then to get the go-ahead to... okay, we'll put this out in the market. But the thing I like about the Titleist driver is that Larry and I, teaching golf in Clubland, it's probably normal.
Clubland,
it's probably normal just for someone to be getting 80 miles an hour of club head speed, whereas we're looking at these guys on tour, they're getting 115 to 120 and even not more.
Yeah.
But the Titleist driver works very well for someone at 70 miles an hour to 90 miles an hour. So clearly there's still that benefit. So the club's not, or the ball's not just for golf pros that are producing exorbitant speeds.
Yeah, one of the things they've done, and I know you've had Jason Budd on in the past on the podcast, but one of the things they've been able to do as well with the speed and forgiveness is there's, we've got 16 settings on the side in the hosel. This new GTS model, we can move more weight around the head to give that forgiveness and get it, give that lift if the player needs a bit more flight, get their spin rates really dialed in as well. So there's heaps of variability or flexibility in the heads to suit every golfer. There'll be plenty of people out at the Aussie Gaz that'll...
Oh, no, the Titleist drive's been really good. Really good for us out there at the Australian.
Doesn't that put like a full stop, inverted commas, exclamation mark on the end of the word get fitted? Let's do it. Get fitted.
Well, yeah, it's interesting with Matt's role. I'm sure Matt can go into more detail, but when you go to a golf tournament, you go to the Australian PGA, Australian Open, you go to the Victorian Amateur, and you've got the players there, and they'll obviously in that those practice rounds from the Monday afternoon through to Wednesday evening, you would have them all lined up on trying different shafts, different heads. For the individual, for that algorithm of getting everything together, that would be quite a challenge too with the player and the way they are swinging on that particular week. That's obviously a challenge for you guys in that short time frame as well.
Look, that's part of the service we offer to the guys. I mean, in a perfect world, we get them in when they're not on tournament site, but you always, you know, I've got a couple of club fitters that go to each event with me, and you always have those guys there that are struggling with something. They might be coming back from injury, they might have increased their speed, they might not be swinging it well that week, and they're kind of looking for a bit of a band-aid to match a club up with their swing for the week. Obviously at the speeds they're swinging it, you know, the boys roll out, they've got literally hundreds of shafts to choose from, and fitting a driver to the particular swing, even the professional swing changes from week to week. It's really like a fingerprint. You're just trying to dial it in as close to what they actually need at that particular time to get it right. I think, you know, even going back to Scotty when he won the Masters, I think that was the first week he put in a new driver that week. He'd obviously done a bit of testing at home and chose to put it in that week and won. So they definitely go through the process. There's so many options now just to dial it in for their particular speed and swing on that week. It's really quite amazing. We've got over 80 guys in the R&D department in Titleist Golf Clubs there now. And, you know, each time they bring out a driver, you kind of go to the conference and what are they going to do this time? But they keep amazing you with what they can put out.
You mentioned Adam Scott there, Matt. Is he as perfect as he looks? I mean, is it... He just seems like, you know, is he real?
Yeah, he's real. He's real.
So does he get his shits with anything? Does anything...
Funny story with Adam, he played the... Going back to 2013, you know, he'd come back after the Masters and he was playing... I think that year they had the Australian Masters and the World Cup back-to-back weeks at Royal Melbourne. And he came in to collect his golf balls and... You know, you're getting pulled from here to there. You got to go and do this, Adam, and the media want to talk to him. So I put his balls in his locker, and he was using an older model ball at the time. So he never come back to collect them, but he put them in his locker. And I get this phone call the next morning. I'm lying in my bed in Brisbane at 5 a.m., and it's Adam Scott. And he says, oh, I didn't get back to get my balls. Did you leave them? I said, yeah, mate, they're in your locker. Da, 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 da. I said, oh, thanks, Matt. Da, da, da. Hang up the phone. And my wife says, was that Adam Scott on the phone? So she liked the sound of his voice.
Yeah, oh, look, I like the sound of his voice.
So when Scotty goes to get his golf balls for the week, does he just get four balls?
Does he say thank you?
Is that all he needs, one ball a day? Or
they get two or three dozen each week. But I think Adam probably signs a few at the end of the week to give to the kids.
And they're all different. Would Scotty use like a ball for three holes and change it, play another three holes and rotate it around? Or are the balls getting better now that they can just use the ball if it's...
Yeah, look, they can use it. I've got players, Zach Murray, for instance, he'll often come in and just grab one dozen. He's, you know, use the same ball for the whole 18 holes. You know, players are like, Gaz. Some will change it after every birdie. They have 8 under for the day, they'll go through 9 balls. Some will change it after 9 holes. Working for a golf ball company, I've started doing that, change it after 9 holes, but I wasn't doing that when I was a school teacher.
That's right, you're a school
teacher.
That's
right, yeah. Yeah, maybe that's why we all listen to you, is it?
Some, you have to ask my kids.
So what about the ball? Like, so we've got the probably, you know, I'm not sure what you're going to come up with here, but you've got the Pro V1, you've got the Pro V1X, so you've got one. Is it about 50-50, the guys on tour?
The left dash too.
Yeah, you've got the high spinning ball, the lower spinning ball. Is it about 50-50 when you go to a tournament? Are you taking...
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, it does vary, you know, one or two each week, but predominantly it's 50-50. We carry, you know, on the Aussie Tour, I'll go, we'll have the 2025X and V1, and we carry last model as well, 2023X and V1, because it's spun a bit less with shots under 100 metres.
Oh, okay.
So there's some players that, you know, they've won with that ball or for whatever reason, you know, it works for what they're trying to do with their wedges. So we keep them running while there's players using them. We've got, you know, we've got a left dash and a lower spinning Pro V1 as well. But basically, 95% of the guys we deal with on the Aussie Tour, and it's probably 90-plus percent on World Tours, are in the current Pro V1X that you can buy off the shelf. Pretty close to 50-50. You know, we work off feel, flight and spin, so the V1, you know, some people won't play the V1 because it feels like a marshmallow.
Mm.
And then other people will say, well, the X feels like a rock.
Too hard.
They'll make their, you know, a big part of their decision will be the feel of the ball. Others will do it on the flight, so the V1's lower and the X is higher, and then others will do it on the spin. X spins more than the V1, so... But it's not, I always say to the players, that spin rate's not, you know, Iron Byron. It's not North Pole to South Pole. It's closer together. So they just go out and do the testing process.
Do they factor the putting into, Matt, when they're choosing to build them?
Oh, I think feel's a big part of putting, right? But typically we'll start with them from 100 metres, 100 yards in,
right,
and make sure they can play all their shots there and then kind of work back through the bag into irons and back into the driver. There's so much, we're just talking about the driver, there's so much you can do with the driver now to get the right flight by adjusting shafts and settings on the driver where you've positioned the weight, that if you've got the ball dialed in for your irons and your wedges, you know, you've got more room to move dialing a driver in than you have a 5-iron.
We're talking about balls and stuff and drivers. I was looking at Cameron Young's, what's in his bag, he's just won the Cadillac, and he had a GTS 7 wood in his bag. Is it a bit the same when you say 50-50 with the ball? Is it a bit the same with driving irons, hybrids, and lofted fairway woods? Or it seems like there's a bit of a rush on fairway woods for the tour guys.
Definitely in Australia, we're more in utilities.
Yeah.
In your 2 and your 3-irons, just for the conditions. The UK is probably a bit like that as well, keeping it down and controlling it off the tee. Whereas the US, there's a definite slant towards, you know, putting in those higher lofted fairway woods where they can, you know, if they're playing in the dome, they can just hit it. This one goes 227 and, you know, there's no wind, or is it 227 up in the air and it'll stop where it lands. So, you know, the club fitters that work with me, we do very few high lofted fairways.
Yeah, okay.
In this GTS model, they've got better as well. Like in the old days, they used to kind of spin right up.
Yeah,
so we've been able to take spin out of them, so they kind of just launch high, but they still get affected by the breeze.
That's just not that ballooning effect, so it's just going through the wind a bit more.
As well, Matty, you do a lot of work at the grassroots as well. Like, you go to a lot of amateur events. You know, you travel a lot. You're hardly at home. As far as your role as well, are you always got your eye out for really good up and young players, like in the role of leadership to look at?
Yeah, so I guess the best way to just, the role's kind of split basically down the middle. Like 50% of the role is looking after the Aussie Tour pros and what they do, what they need, and then the other 50% is identifying the next tour pro. So I guess if, you know, you had my boss on the line and we're looking for a job description, we're looking for the next Cameron Smith that's going to represent the brand really well. So, you know, I'm looking for a good person first and foremost.
Yep.
If you're going to put a title hat on the head, we want them to be. I say to the kids, you know, you got Cameron Smith, you know, Cam Davis, Adam Scott. I said they're kind of the guys that have come through. I said, no bad publicity. I mean, Cam Smith went to Live and there was a bit of bad publicity around that, but he did it the right way and he's come out of it pretty good. So we're looking for good people first. There's plenty of good golfers out there. But then I go and watch it. So we attend all the state junior amateurs around the country and the state amateurs, and I actually want to see some of these kids hit bad shots and see what their reaction is, right? They don't want to hit a bad shot in front of me, but you want to see what their reaction is, kind of get an idea of, you know, are they well-liked? Have they got a lot of friends? You kind of identify that good person, and then we work with them then to try and help them reach their potential, whatever that ceiling is. You know, Cam Smith, his potential has been pretty good. Lydia Kay, we worked with a lot when I started in this role, and, you know, she's a lovely person, and she's obviously a very good golfer as well. So
it's interesting that there's the type of person you want to wear the Titleist hat. Yeah.
As Matt says, plenty of great golfers out there.
But some dickheads is...
But obviously, to represent the brand, you definitely...
Titleist has that, doesn't it? Matt just, you know, he mentions Cam Davis. I mean, he's just a fantastic bloke, isn't he? Cam Smith, Adam Scott, they're all really nice people. There's no chance for me, Gaz.
Any great moments you can recall on? Any things that have happened out there that you can remember?
I've had quite the journey with Cam Smith, you know, from a young guy over the last 16 years or so. Quick story there. I started in this role in 2011, and Jim Ahern was a famous guy in the US. He'd done his role all over the US, and you know, with everyone from Tiger down, anyone that played tight was, had something to do with Jim Ahern. And we stand behind the third green at Victoria, and Cameron Smith comes up and he shortside himself. And I said to Jim, I said, this kid's got the best short game in Australia. He's 16 at the time. Has to go over this bunker, short-sided pin, flubs it in the trap. My first week. my first week in the job. So he's kind of looked at me. Have we picked the right bloke here? Anyway, walks in the trap, holds the trap.
Oh, no way.
Is that safe to say that he saved your job?
Could have been a short career. Nearly ended it and saved it in the space of 2 minutes. But, oh, look, to see him go on and win, you know, be successful, he's been players, championships and the Open, and he hasn't changed at all. He comes back to Queensland and he plays, had a game of golf with a couple of kids out at Capera where I play. My son and a couple of his mates just loves it and loves kind of giving back. Lydia Coe was actually the first. I met Lydia as a 12-year-old. Her coach, Guy Wilson, brought her over to Melbourne and sat down in our office there, and nice young kid, and watching her develop and play, like, she used to hit them out of a divots. Yeah. Just methodical down the fairway, same club in. Like, if you had his on the left edge, she hit it at a right pin, she did it a metre inside the rough line. You know, I don't see her a lot these days. Don't play a lot in Australia and or New Zealand, but if I send her a message, she always replies, and just a great person to be around. And I guess the other one, we got a lot out of the last two New Zealand Open winners, Ryan Peake. He was in squads with Cam as a junior and as a young bloke and kind of lost his way a bit there. But, you know, I don't know if I've ever been as excited for someone when he come out the other end winning that New Zealand Open last year. Really cool part to, you know, he called me up when he started getting back into the game, and just a ripping lad as well. You know, everyone, you know, we all have our troubles throughout our lives, but he's a really good lad. And then Daniel Hillier won New Zealand Open this year, which was, you know, emotional for Dan, but we've kind of been working with him since he was about 16, and just a salt of the earth kid and lovely family and lovely wife now. And, you know, you can see how emotional he was. It's hard to hold it back yourself watching him. So, yeah, a lot of highlights, but they're some of the ones that stand out.
Daniel's got to be a potential major winner, doesn't he? I mean, his career, the last 7 or 8 months of his career has been extraordinary. I mean, he's such a player, and he plays well when it matters, doesn't he, mate?
Yeah, he had a very good end to last year. You know, and I think that helped him with the New Zealand Open win at the start of this year. You know, he played in some of those bigger end-of-season events in Europe and, you know, teeing it up in the same group as Rory and performing well. So he's certainly still on the upward spiral, that's for sure.
Ryan Peake's a great story, isn't it? That doesn't get talked about enough. When Anthony Kim's win in Adelaide this year, that was extraordinary. That's a movie. But Ryan Peake, I reckon that's a bloody ripper of a movie.
That's a movie?
Yeah.
And so, you know, I haven't met the guy, only in, you know, media centers.
I saw a young fella started playing a bit of golf. And at the time, I got him to caddy for, I said, oh, can I go and caddy at the Queensland PGA? And I said, who can I get him a caddy for? You know, 18-year-old, and you're trying to get a few life lessons. So he caddied for Ryan the first couple of days. You know, Ryan's trying to read the Queensland greens. And anyway, they missed the cut. But, you know, Ben did a Google search on him before the round and kind of, what do you got me into, Dad? Yeah. Mate, don't judge a book by its cover. And Peggy still sends him a message now. Like, they're connected. They had a great couple of days. He slipped him a bunch of money at the end after he was told not to. But really good human.
Yeah, there it is. Yeah, that's good to hear, isn't it? We need him on the show. I reckon Ryan would be a great
bit. Yeah, he would be amazing to get on.
And Daniel Hillier. I'm wrapped in Daniel. And Gaz, you saw him at the Australian Open, didn't you? Daniel Hillier
he's
special, isn't he?
He's world class. Yeah, he's world class.
So what's he need to do to get to that next level? Because when he was featuring on Europe last year, it was like weekly. He was either in the lead or near the lead, but couldn't get it over the line. Gets it over the line in the New Zealand Open, when it probably matters more to him emotionally than any other tournament. So that's going to be a big breakthrough for him, right?
I suppose, Matt, you've seen them all, and Daniel Hillier, he's definitely top 50 player in the world, isn't he?
Yeah, he's had a couple of the last 2 years. He was pretty gutted at the end of last year. He just missed out, I think, by one spot to get the PGA Tour card.
Yeah.
You know what it's like. I mean, it's hard. You kind of go through in stages. There's so many good players out there, and you just kind of got to get a bit better each year, and then you got to take your chance when it comes along. You know, they keep throwing this trending word around, the young people, but he's certainly trending.
What do you think about the ball moving forward, the rollback? What's your ideas on that?
It's interesting. I mean, the first thing I'll say, Gaz, is well above my pay grade, but I know our guys are working closely with the USGA and the RNA and trying to come up with a a solution that kind of everyone's happy with. I guess the, you know, the position we take is that the game's really healthy. Like, we've never had anyone, we've never had more people playing the game or interested in the game. The rules they're trying to implement are rules, you know, for 0.0001 of the population, the very best players in the world, the people at the top of the pyramid we talk about. Mm. And at the end of the day, they're supposed to be really good guys, aren't they, Larry? So
they're
supposed to be good.
I'm sniffing there that you're not a massive fan of the rollback concept.
No, man. Well, I don't go out and play a Capera on a Saturday and have people say, I want to hit it shorter. so, you know, there's a bunch of challenges with it. You know, it'll play out, as I said.
Yeah, Fred Ridley was pretty vocal,
wasn't he?
Chairman of the Masters.
Yeah.
He was talking about how far the guys were hitting it and how there's no more land to keep buying to increase length of golf courses. But if it does happen, what I can't understand, why wouldn't they just say, well, whatever it is right now, whatever the ball is right now, why take it back to, I believe it's the ball that was about 2007, something like that. I think it's about 15 yards shorter. Am I close to that?
Look, funnily enough, there's a lot to work out. There's a bunch of specifications around what they're trying to do, but we've done some testing with players where the rollback ball goes further than the current ball.
You're kidding.
So it's
depending on their swing conditions, is that correct?
Yeah, correct. Yeah.
Okay.
So it's not quite as simple as saying we'll just take 15 yards off it, or we'll. It's harder to do than it sounds.
Gee, yeah.
We've done a lot of testing with a lot of players. With the same deal there, I think we've got more people in golf ball R&D than we have in club R&D, 80 or more. And,
oh, really?
You know, this was coming in 2028, so we've done a lot of testing with it. Yeah, for some players it goes further.
That's extraordinary.
So, you know, we've got to work together with the RNA and the USGA and work out how it's going to play out.
And Titleist would be at the forefront. That'd be the most respected opinion on golf balls. Easily, surely.
Would that be a rollback ball for everyone playing golf? Or just the pros playing
golf? You know, it's a percent of how far you hit it. That's the really simplistic concept that I have of it. Is just if you hit it 200 yards, you might lose 2 yards. If you hit it 300 yards, you could lose 10 yards. That didn't make any sense at all, did it?
And Cameron Young could hit it further, and Zach could hit it shorter. so you're in a good spot if you're Cameron Young.
You've picked two beauties out there. They've picked two rippers there, Zach Johnson.
And what about, just before we let you go, Matty, when you're on tour now and you're looking at just the players week in, week out, what percentage are still using blades?
Oh, that's a strange question, Gaz, but a good one.
Is it going away?
Yeah, there's not many now. We've got a lot of blended sets. There's a lot of, like, if you look at a Vokey wedge, like, we go down to a pitching wedge now. Now, that's essentially a blade, right?
Yeah.
So there's still players that are in blades, say, from 7-iron down.
Yeah.
I'd have to check with the club guys, but I don't think we'd have a player in a 4-iron blade now. They might be in a CB, you know. So we might have players in 7-iron down, and then they go 4-6 in there in a CB, cavity back, and then into a utility after that. No, there's not many. We haven't actually brought out a new blade model for 6 or 8 years now.
Oh, there you go. Yeah,
because you kind of go to the player, well, what do you want? You know, there's your blade. What would you change? And it's very hard for players to verbalise that, what they want. They've got a few models on the PGA Tour that are specific. I think they did a JT model. Like, some people like a longer blade, some people like a higher blade. So they kind of went into more of a custom setup for those guys, you know, the real high-profile guys that wanted a blade. Look, Cameron Davis has still got blades in his bag at the top end. But yeah, there's not a lot there.
I was in Singapore last week for the Singapore Open, and I was looking just in the small time I was there on the putting green, you know, practice rounds before the round. It looks like about 80% of the guys on the putting green now, at least 80, I'm almost going to go to 90, have some form of mallet putter. Yeah. Even the classic Scotty Cameron, well, we call it a blade now, but it's that old, you know, that
ping answer.
Yeah. But even that's going away now. Is that fair to say? Like,
Yeah. I was going to say, like, people, you know, when you ask about irons, you know, people are going away from blade putters. They're going for a more forgiving putter. We're probably not as that high in Aussie. It's probably closer to 50-50 blade to mallet.
So we've still got quite a following here in Australia with the blade.
Yeah, look, I think people like, even personally, I'd prefer to putt with a blade-type putter. It just looks so simple and so good. But, you know, when you actually get it out on the green and start rolling it and see a bit of data, I'm a better putter when I use something that's more of a, you know, we call them mid-mallet. I've got a square back, which is, I guess, that old traditional Newport blade shape with a little bit added to the back of it.
Yeah, so another one. So the square back, which, gee, I'm going back to the 2005, 2004. When I was at Scotty Cameron at the studio, they, Paul Vazenko, who's obviously Scotty's club maker, club fitter back then, he said that the squareback was the best, most forgiving putter they'd ever made. And then Michael Sim used a squareback, and Simmy was one of the best putters in the world.
Yeah.
And Simmy still has the squareback, I think, even to this day. That's a genius, that putter.
Yeah, yeah. Simmy's got the, at the studio there, it goes, you might know, but he's actually got the record. Like, I think it's a 20-foot, maybe 25-foot straight putt.
Yeah.
He's got the record for most holed in a row. And everyone that's ever been there, Tiger, Ricky Fowler was one of the best that ever had through there. And I can never remember the exact number, but it's stamped on his square back. It's over 40. It's 43 or 45 or something like that in a row. I was talking to him the other week. He tells the story that, you know, someone walked into the studio as he was hitting his 46th putt or 44th putt, and the door banged and he missed that one.
And being a
was that Tiger banging the door?
He would have had a Tiger's cap on, so he wouldn't have reacted. He'd have taken it calmly, moved along.
Yeah, another good guy.
Another ripper. There. Yeah.
So you've been to TPI obviously many times. That's the Titleist Performance Institute. It's in San Diego. It's sort of the leader of technology.
Yeah, I've heard of it.
It was the brainchild of Wally Uline, I believe, back in the early 2000s to create a environment where everything from strength and conditioning to club fitting to R&D. And Matt Jones and I were there 1 year and we were testing out some wedges. And there's this building dedicated to wedges on the back of the range, or one of the ranges there. And when Matt was talking about these guys from R&D, this guy comes out like in a white coat.
No,
he did. It was like
you have a comb over?
No, it was like you're at NASA. And he sort of opened the door, and Matt and I walked up to the door, and he sort of gingerly handed out a couple of irons, and we said, "Can we come in?" He said, "I know you can't come in here.
Oh,
I know you can't come in here." It was like something that was in there that not even we could even
Area 51.
We couldn't even see what was in there. It was like, gee, my God, like what is this place?
It's a unique brand, and it's going to, you know, it always will never change, will it?
I remember when I first went there, Matt, with Matt Jones in about 2003. We turn up to the car park, and you've got to go through about four security gates to get in there. It's like you're at NASA.
Yeah.
And at that time, I was with Ping, because I came.
And then one of them didn't let you in.
No, I think Matty and I, we got together in about 2006, 2007, when I went with Titleist. But I had a Ping shirt on, and I wasn't allowed in there. She was a really nice girl at the reception. She said, "Look, I'm sorry, you can't come in here with that Ping shirt on."
Yeah.
I thought it was a joke, and it was actually quite serious.
Until two blokes grabbed you around the shoulder.
No, she had to go and get me like a Titleist shirt to put on.
Good grief.
Things have evolved. I quite like that now. No, John Rahm actually goes in there and trains. John, he works with Dave Phillips.
Yeah, it's all changed.
One of the guys there. And,
yeah, because Dave Phillips and Greg Rose, they sort of took it over, didn't they, quite a few years ago?
Yeah, they do all the body screening, and Dave's John's coach. John's there a lot. The world's evolving, guys, isn't it?
Yeah. Matt, it's been a pleasure to have you on the show, mate. Thank you so much. You've been very insightful, and just keep that Titleist brand going, mate. Just keep the quality of that product.
Thank you very much for having me, guys.
Thanks again, Matt. Hopefully we'll get to talk to you very soon.
Thanks, mate.
Thanks, guys.
You're tuned to Backspin. 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 With Larry Canning and Gary Barter.
I'd like to mention our friends at BMW. They've been long-standing supporters of golf, not only in Australia, but around the world for over 35 years. And they continue to be a huge part of the landscape of our game. It's not just international PGA Tour golf. 45 years ago, BMW created the world's largest amateur golf tournament with around 100,000 golfers from 50 countries competing worldwide. The BMW Cup is the most renowned and largest international tournament series for non-professional golfers. If any listeners are interested in being part of this amazing event, contact your nearest BMW dealer. From a long-standing PGA member, thank you, BMW.
Feeling hungry for a tasty tip? Here it is.
All their tips seem to be based around me, which I don't mind.
You're representing the average player.
I've waited a long time to be able to say that. But hear someone say it, yes, but you're dead right. I've been fiddling around. I still have problems with my long irons, long stuff. You know, obviously the driver is a separate issue, but, you know, long irons, I used to love long irons, and I have fiddled with utility irons, driving irons, call them what you like, because I have had trouble with the hybrids. I don't really understand how to hit them properly. But irons, I love teed up on a tee, hitting off a, you know, tight par four or something. There's no real par fours now that warrant me hitting an iron off a tee. I need a really good driver, and that's just a safe place so I can get it onto the fairway, reach the fairway. So how do I hit a hybrid? And I got them back out again the other day, and I'm trying to sweep them off like a fairway would, and I'm not getting any in the air, and not getting enough spin, and I thought, well, the shafts are too stiff, the lofts are wrong. And then I thought, I'll just move it back in my stance and hit it like an iron, like I would like a 5 or 6 iron. And I got the ball up in the air and spun it nicely. I had a couple of mishits, which I'm working on, but what is the difference between a hybrid, a long iron, and a wood? Where does it fit in the way you actually try and hit the ball?
Yeah, it's a good question, because you've got your driver, which we know ideally we'd like to hit up on the ball. So if you get any of those ball flight monitors, you know, you'd like to see that your driver is probably 1, 2, 3 up on the ball. If you've got a lot of speed, like a pro, you can definitely come in more 0 or 1 down.
But like generally, a young pro.
Yeah, generally for most of us, you definitely want to be hitting up on the ball. I think the data from the LPGA Tour, the girls playing at the highest level, their average is sort of 2 or 3 up on the ball with the driver.
Yeah, okay.
And then your low point.
Which is good for us to look at, isn't it? Those numbers are more relative to.
Yeah, and really the girls are hitting it miles now anyway. If you look at their club head speed with the driver, it's average now at about 98 miles an hour.
Mm.
And I think the guys on the Champions Tour are about 104 miles an hour. Yeah, 103 miles an hour. But you're looking at, you know, most of the members of the club, if you look at them across the board, they're about between 80 miles an hour and about, you know, 90 miles an hour. So you're looking at that sort of speed. So with your driver, you definitely want to be hitting up on the ball. And then as you get to like a 3 wood, you're coming in at about 0.
Oh, okay.
So you're sort of like flat on the ground. Mm. And then when you're talking about your hybrids, if you had that philosophy, like you said, of sweeping it with the hybrid, usually being a smaller head and a shallower profile, as in from the bottom of the club to the top of the club, if you're sweeping it, you're going to be getting it too much on the bottom of the club.
Yes, that's what I'm getting.
It's really firm on the bottom of the club, but also too, you're hitting sort of halfway up the ball.
Yeah, yeah.
And then you're getting that domey.
Yes, it just falls out of the air really quick.
Yeah, and just through your self-discovery, just thought, well, I'll play it back a bit and hit down on it. Then you've got the opportunity for the ball to climb up the face more.
Yeah, that's what I found.
And then the angle of attack being a little more down on the ball, so you'd be looking at, say, 2 down on the ball, that's going to catapult the ball, that beautiful algorithm of the speed and the angle of attack and where you're hitting in the face of the club, as a little higher on the face of the club, then you're going to get some flight.
Mm.
So you've got that by putting the ball back, and you didn't really have to change your swing that much.
No, I just hit it like a 5-iron or a 6-iron. Just try, like, you know, take a divot.
And you've probably got enough speed even now for that to work. But if someone doesn't have a lot of speed, they could play the ball a little more forward, but they've still got to be mindful that they can't try to sweep it up that much.
Mm.
And originally a rescue, which is we call now a hybrid, that was originally named a rescue to sort of rescue you out of...
Yeah, out of trouble, out of rough and stuff. Yes, yeah. It was that, wasn't it?
Now, you and I came through an era where we were told if we're in the rough, to hit down on the ball.
Because
hitting down on the ball and get the ball up.
Yep.
And in its sort of industrial form, that does work. But then we'd get flyers. Remember back in the day, we'd get these irons that would just catapult too far. But the little rescue club, the little hybrid hitting down on the ball in the rough works unbelievably.
Mm.
So, yeah, whether someone needs a golf lesson or they've got the ability to understand about hitting a bit more down, or as you said, make it simple, play the ball back in the stance a bit, I think that's a great tip.
Okay, thanks, yes.
So you've done well there, Larry.
Thank you. I don't know what to say next.
You've actually picked the right fix.
Wow. Okay. I'm a little bit lost for words. A little bit emotional, actually. Gaz, just a little tear. But thank you, mate. Thank you, folks. That's our show. We would love your feedback on our Facebook page or Instagram or anywhere you can find us about LIV Golf. If you've got some opinions on whether it should go, what the answer might be. Is it a good thing? Is it a bad thing? I reckon it's a good thing.
It's a shame the whole time it's just been...
Bagged.
Yeah. God, it's been the whole time. Shocking, it's just, mate. We've spoken many times about LIV, and it's always been a controversial...
Yeah.
component to the golfing world. Yet
you've been to 20 of them. I've been to 4 of them. It's a special event. It really is. You have to be there, and which is a shame. That's why it's, you know, struggling to a degree.
Anyway,
thanks, folks, and we'll see you next time we have a Backspin podcast.